Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U. By everyone.org, that's everyone.org, one of the coolest new race series around. First event coming up in July in NorCal and then San Diego in December. RunCatalina.com, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $70 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. And, of course, you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. Our next guest, probably one of the best public relations guys I have ever worked with. We have worked together for years and years. His name is Lawrence Cohen. The company is TLC Media Works. Lawrence, how the heck are you?
Bob, I couldn't be better. Anytime I get to talk to you is a good day, whether we're on the radio or not.
I love that. So, Lawrence, we first started working together when you were running the LA Marathon, the PR over there. Talk a little bit about the challenges of running a big city marathon. And with all, you got so many different stories, you got so much different media. How do you keep that type of stuff together?
Well, you know, for me, the LA Marathon made it kind of easy because they had a wonderful charity program in place. They already had like 50 different charities that somehow used the race as a platform to raise money. So that was always a good place to start for me. I'll give you a great example.
Yeah.
There was a guy named John Ball. John was a Honda employee, and Honda actually sponsored the race for many, many years. And John was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And he had done a lot of research, real smart guy, and he saw that if he exercised on a regular basis, that could somehow help him manage the symptoms and the tremors. So we thought, well, if exercise is good, running a marathon would be completely good. So he took it upon himself to run his first marathon. And from that point forward, not only was it did it successfully help him manage his tremors, but he realized he could reach out to other people in the Parkinson's community to run with him. So over his kitchen table, he and his wife started Team Parkinson's. And within 5 years, not only did they have many, many people with Parkinson's running with them, but as a group, they raised $1 million for Parkinson's
Wow.
research and treatments.
You know, the other
Pretty
thing.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, really amazing. I think the thing that I think L.A. brought to the table, before L.A. Marathon, you had Boston, you had New York, you had Chicago, you had major marathons. But I don't think those events really focused on the age group athlete or the charity programs the way that L.A. embraced right from the beginning.
And I think because I worked on the event for 15 years, and in the very early years, they had one of my favorite medals, and it was like a star on Hollywood Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And on one side it said the Los Angeles Marathon with the logo, and on the other side it said where every runner is a star. And as you know, Bill Burke and Murray Patrick were the co-founders of the LA Marathon, and it was actually conceived of as the first for-profit marathon. And they always wanted to step up the game. And you know, Bill always made it a priority to focus on all the runners behind the elite field because, as he said, you know, the elite runners don't pay an entry fee.
Right.
They're, you know, I'm interested in making sure that we take really good care of everyone behind those 30 or so elite athletes.
You mean the consumer?
Yeah, the consumer, the everyday runner. Yeah, that was his thing because, you know, those were his customers.
Well, and that was what he was. Right, he considered himself, you know, when he finally did run a marathon, he considered himself a back-of-the-pack guy, so he certainly could relate.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in fact, I know probably one of the last races that Bill actually ran was with Fred LeBeau.
Right.
And it was Fred's last marathon before cancer finally claimed his life. And It was a powerful experience for Bill. Bill, you know, on the surface, he's such an interesting guy because he's a mass of contradictions. On one level, he's a very shrewd, calculating business guy. But on the other hand, he's a guy with a tremendous amount of heart. And L.A., you know, he started an award called the Patsy Choco Courage Award. And every year we actually had a luncheon celebrating people that exemplified that kind of courage. Patty was diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer, and she was in the final stages of training to run a race, and her doctor said, you're not going to be able to run the race. And she reached out to Bill, you know, maybe 10 months later and said, you know, we've gone through all these treatments. It doesn't look good for me, but I would still like to do your race. Would it be okay if my husband came out on the course with me with a wheelchair, and in the event I can't finish the race, he can help me get to the finish line? Well, Alan Choco was with her every step of that 26.2 miles. She never needed the wheelchair, and she died maybe a few months later, and some 300 LA Marathon runners came to her funeral, and they put their medals in her grave.
The thing about L.A., if you think about the standard marathons, Boston, New York, Chicago, L.A. had a bike ride. At one time, they had a skate. People skated for parts of 5K.
It was the rollerblade year.
Right,
we did do that.
Yeah, so you had that. The TV show, because you guys had the challenge where the women went off first, and then the guys tried to run them down. That became, I think that had higher ratings than any city marathon ever had.
It did, and I'm proud to say that I actually named the challenge.
Yes.
Before that, they were calling it that Tony Revis and Phil Olsman, our television producer, they basically came up with the concept, but they were calling it, you know, the men versus the women, and I said, we're long past Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King. We have to have some other way to brand this. And I came up with the concept of calling it The Challenge. And I think it's even stuck to this day.
And the ratings were huge. And it was almost like watching Pac-Man on television. You had a woman from the Ukraine or a woman from Russia leading, and you had a guy from Kenya or Ethiopia trying to chase her down. And it didn't really matter if you knew who these people were. All you knew was there's a car at stake. There was an extra, I don't know if it was 25 or 50K. And you watched these little dots get closer and closer together. And people were transfixed watching this on television. It was huge.
It was huge. And really, the tune-in was amazing. And it did hold your interest because obviously the women would start. There's a very funny story behind this, by the way. One year, every year we were trying to find up a scientific formula to determine how the gap would be. And it was always, you know, for a while everybody was crunching numbers and predicating it on the science of finishing times and personal bests, and you drop the highest, drop the lowest, whatever. And one year it was 3 days before the race, and we were going into the press conference, and we had to announce what the challenge time differential was going to be. So our elite coordinator, I said, you know, what have you come up with the time differential? And he said, you know, I just haven't figured it out this year. And he said, what year were you born? I said, 1951. He said, that's going to be the time differential.
So we said,
and what was hilarious was it was actually the closest year of any other year up to that
point. That is wild. Didn't look at the guy's PRs, didn't look at the woman's PRs, just pulled the number. I love that. So
yeah, it was
when L.A., and obviously L.A. was a success right off the bat as a big city marathon, when you guys expanded into Vegas and took over what was the Vegas Marathon, used to finish outside. You know, you turned down an alley, you started 25 miles outside of town, you ran with tumbleweed, and then when you got into town, I think you turned into an alley, and you're like, okay, you're done with the Las Vegas Marathon. All of a sudden, it was on the Strip.
Yeah, and in fact, the Tumbleweed won a few different
years,
by
yes,
the way.
I know, but, yeah.
And, well, it was interesting, you know, because L.A. was the first race to have entertainment on the course.
Yes.
And that was, you know, Bill being a showman, we were always looking for ways to make the race more accessible and interesting and keep it fresh. And, you know, when I went to Las Vegas after they acquired the rights to do a Las Vegas marathon, and just to differentiate it from the old one, we called it the new Las Vegas marathon
right.
in the first few years, I toured the course. And in driving the course, I was out there with the race director at the time, and I saw this wedding chapel off the Strip just immediately after we turned off the Strip. And I asked him to pull over, and I went inside the chapel, and I asked if the owner or manager was there. And within a matter of minutes, I said, I'm not sure if you're aware, but there's a marathon that's going to be coming right past here in early December. What do you think of the idea of doing a run-through wedding ceremony? And the guy, he just laughed, and we both laughed. We shook hands, and we used that as a tradition to launch that race. And I'm happy to say that the rock and roll folks still observe that tradition all these years later.
Well, and then, you know, we had been doing, it started with L.A., with a gentleman by the name of Jeff Padilla running as Elvis with some of his friends at L.A., and then when rock and roll started, my feeling was that Elvis should lead the rock and roll. We had, you know, we'd have 8, 10, 12 Elvi running rock and roll San Diego. But your thought with Vegas was, well, wait a second. We don't want to just have 8 or 10 Elvi. We want to have the biggest collection of Elvi ever assembled. When you're talking about people putting on white lycra or black lycra and traveling from all over the world to come to Vegas, it's a little bit like herding cats trying to get all these people together. Talk a little bit about deciding that, hey, we need to blow this thing up. We need to make this Elvis thing, make a major statement with Elvis and Las Vegas Marathon.
Well, outside of Graceland, Las Vegas is the spiritual home of Elvis Presley.
Right.
And it just made total sense to me that we needed to do whatever we could to drive interest in the people who love Elvis. Viva Las Vegas, for God's sake, is, you know, the theme song for Las Vegas, if it ever had one. And when we started reaching out to the people that were already running as Elvis, and they all said, I'm in, I'm in, I'm in, I'm in. And then we went to other people and said, you know, running the Las Vegas Marathon is one thing, but running the Las Vegas Marathon as Elvis is a whole other thing. And we had, in year one, we had a private pasta party and it was an all Elvi pasta party. It was so successful that in year two, we expanded the pasta party to include the general runners that are part of the marathon. And we had like 400 people show up, and we did Elvis karaoke, people went crazy for. And, you know, year after year, more people were coming in. You know, we had men running as Elvis and women running as Priscilla. We had female Elvi. We had these folks became their own kind of family within the family. And I know you're close with several of the people that run as Elvi, and you yourself run as Elvis a lot of the time.
Absolutely.
And there's even a woman who I think makes her entire living making Elvi, running Elvi costumes.
I think I put her kids through college by making Elvis outfits. Yeah, Misty Elvis. Then you decide to merge things together. Okay, we got the couples who are going to either get married or renew their vows. We got the running Elvi. So let's make the Elvi the witnesses for the couples getting married. At its height, how many couples were getting married?
Well, here's the good thing. It actually has taken on a life of its own, and it's gotten bigger and bigger every year. The last year I worked on Rock and Roll Las Vegas was 2 years ago, and I think we were at about 130-some-odd couples.
Wow.
And And here's the other part of it. You know, when I told Bill Burke about this idea, he thought, that's a really bad idea. And I said, yeah, Bill, but you love your money, and you know you'll get at least two people running instead of one and pay an entry fee. And the part that I didn't see was that whole running clubs would want to come out and be part of that, too. So we would have, you know, 100-some-odd couples, but then you'd have an additional 300 to 400 people that registered for the race because they wanted to be part of that moving wedding ceremony. And, it was extraordinary.
And it was really fun. It was really fun my wife and I renewed our vows as in our Elvis outfits, which was a blast. And you'd moved it around. One year you were in front of Paris, right, in front of the Eiffel Tower. And then another year it was you moved it around a few different hotels.
Everywhere. We did it on the bridge heading into the Venetian Hotel.
Oh, that's right, yes.
We did it at I thought of the fantastic year was the year we did it on the bridge in front of New York, New York.
Yes.
Which was our way to pay homage to the New York Marathon. And, of course, the original venue was the run-through wedding ceremony was at one of those chapels.
Right.
And there was never a shortage of places to do it. Probably the only year that didn't go well was we did it on the start line, and we thought it would be a 26.2-mile honeymoon. But start line logistics are particularly when you got like 30,000 people running,
yeah,
so it's a little challenging.
So for when you're there's a lot of races out there, and when you're in charge of trying to create media, not just local media but national media around an event, take me through the process of, you know, coming up with the run through wedding chapel. You just happen to see that while you're driving through, but you know that you have to do something to separate your event from the others that are out there. What's the process?
Well, you know, part of I appreciate the nice compliment about me being one of the better PR people in the marathon business. I think it's a specialty, and I think in order to understand what it is to do public relations for a race, you have to have been a marathon runner. And I've run 5 marathons. I understand the demographic, and I understand what appeals to the demographic. You know, people wear their medals to work the day after they run a race. Some people wear them all week. And so for me, I never wanted to, I don't know how to say this without having it sound critical of the industry these days, but I think there's a standardization of companies that own multiple races. And, you know, cynically, I thought one year, you know what, because sponsors drive, you know,
sure.
Sponsors make everything happen. And one year I thought, you know what, I'd like to design a race that has a built-in sponsor that has to happen. So I don't know if you remember a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago, McDonald's was very criticized for the nutritional quality
of, course, yes,
of their
uh-huh.
food. And then they launched that. They started having, they would pull a big van into expos, and they'd be showcasing their healthier
products. Yes.
And I was looking at it one day at the L.A. Marathon, and I thought, someone should start a series called the McMarathons. And the idea would be that you would run, the course would be designed around marathon locations, and at each McDonald's location, they would showcase another one of their healthier selections of food, in addition to being just like their normal water stops.
It's a great idea.
I thought so too, and somebody, if they're listening, can make it happen, you know, by first place. I don't think it should be a paint-by-numbers profession. I think every race has the potential to reflect the community in which the race is held. And so when I look at an event, for example, the Country Music Marathon, when the competitor group first took that over, I thought, why not do the pasta party on one of those paddle wheel boats.
Oh, yeah. Great idea.
And have a live band play, because that's the flavor of that community.
Sure. Yep.
If I was doing a race up in, like, say, the Seattle area, I would theme the music around, you know, the Seattle music scene.
Exactly.
Grunge, tribute bands. L.A., for years I thought that the music on the course should really reflect the music history of Los Angeles. Mm. So you'd have an Eagles tribute band, and, you know, at the Hollywood and Vine, you would have a Hollywood and Vine location, and you'd have a Beatles tribute band performing the entire Beatles concert at the Hollywood Bowl, you know,
yes,
over and over and over again as runners went past for the hours of the race. And so I look at each city or community where an event is held and say, what can I do to get showcase the most attractive parts of that community that not only appeal to people who would travel in for the race, but again, let the local community know that the race organizers understand their community.
So when you first heard about the Everyone series and the idea, you know, again, not it's EVERYWON.org. When you first heard about the concept of, you know, that I think the number was something like 5% of people who do races actually raise money for charity and the rest don't. And so the concept was, how do we create something that raises more money for more charities? Talk a little bit about when you first met the folks behind this and when you realized you wanted in.
I got a call from Marie Patrick, the former co-owner of the LA Marathon, and she knew that probably, and she and I actually shared this, that probably the thing that we loved most about the LA Marathon was the charity program.
Right, yes.
There was just something every year after the elites would finish and we would do the Elite Runners News Conference, she and I would find ourselves at the finish line for hours, mesmerized by the people that were coming across. And you get to know the people, and then you see someone who you know. A good example is a guy named Ernie Van Leeuwen, who didn't run his first marathon until he was in his 80s. And when we would see Ernie cross the finish line, and yeah, I know you knew Ernie too.
Yes, very well.
You know, I'd look over and Maria's just sobbing and I'm starting to cry. And we were just so moved by all these people that really did this for a higher purpose. You know, he wanted to show that aging is just a number, and that, you know, and we just kept seeing waves of people whose stories we knew and whose faces we knew. And so even though I really was kind of not necessarily looking for another racing event, much less a race series, when Marie told me about this and realized that the noble aspiration is that 100% of people participating would raise money for local nonprofits, some of which have national and international reach, it was not something I could say. I didn't have to hesitate. I had to say yes.
And we're talking a half marathon and a 5K. The first event,
correct,
will be in Northern Cal. I think it was July 24th, and we're talking between Berkeley and Oakland. What are the challenges? Again, there's the endurance entertainment marketplace right now between Tough Mudder, Spartan Race, Warrior Dash, triathlon, marathon, half marathon. There's more people than ever putting on numbers, but there's more competition than ever before. How do you, as the guy, create something with the Everyone series that stands out above the other events?
I think that, you know, I saw for years, you know, I represented Julie Weiss,
yes,
who ran 52 marathons in 52 weeks.
And 100 marathons overall so far, right?
Yeah, and has raised over $400,000 single-handedly for pancreatic cancer. So for me, I start going back to the well. Like, I'm looking at these nonprofits. We have a community relations person on staff who's going to mobilize their supporters and do what they can to get their supporters out there to make a difference. the business structure is very interesting, because if you get 10 people to register on your team, you get your entry fee waived 100%. So you don't even have to pay to be part of the race. And in fact, I know we have a code, I think, for you, Bob, that if people use your code, and you know, that'll get them $10 off the race. But my job between now and the race, in addition to getting the media part, because media relations is one part, you know, that's making sure that the media knows about the event. But the public relations piece is actually going to come into play here on a much greater scale, because 21 different nonprofits, some of whom have experience, you know, mobilizing participants for races, some have no experience. So between our Tom Houston, our event organizer and the founder, we have a new person on staff that's working with community relations, and me, we're going to do everything we can to showcase these various nonprofits, to mobilize their existing supporters, and encourage people to understand that if you match your passion for running with a purpose, it's a hugely satisfying experience. I'll take it down to a personal level.
Sure.
When I was 39 years old and I was looking up at turning 40, I was grappling with some substance abuse issues. And one day I was just thinking about it, and I thought, you know, what's the opposite of somebody with substance abuse? And I thought, marathon runner. So I attached myself to a training group. Actually, it was the L.A. Lakers, which was the original L.A. Marathon training group. And, you know, I called it my 26.2-mile 12-step program, because lo and behold, 6 months after I started training, I crossed that finish line. Those nasty habits are now 20-some-odd years behind me. And I only got through race day because I realized if I didn't make it about something more than me, I probably wouldn't get through it. So I raised money for homeless families, an organization called Family Assistance Program. And when the miles got tough, because I wasn't a runner at all before that, but when the miles got tough, I reminded myself I'm there for something more than just me.
So you've had a knack for identifying people who have star quality, like a Julie Weiss, right, where you sort of sense that they can, even though they're not some Hollywood star, this person in our world is going to touch a nerve because of their passion. What is it with someone like a Julie that you knew right away this woman was special?
I think it was her story was so compelling. You know, her dad died 35 days after pancreatic cancer diagnosis. And she thought, I've got to do something big in his honor. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, when they say, I'm going to do something for something, you go, yeah, right. You know, we'll see. But with Julie, I first connected with her probably about, I don't know, 14 races into it. And in social media, I was starting to watch her passion and watching her sort of grow in stature as she started doing this. She became bigger than who she was. And we, you know, I reached out and, you know, I said, good, if you're headed somewhere, let me know where you're going. If I can help, I will. And then it became a force to be reckoned with. I volunteered my time for, I would say, up to about race 35. And then I realized this is going to be so big by race day that I would need to get a fee. And she somehow found the money. And it wasn't, you know, a huge fee, but it was just enough to make sure I could give it the time. So
sure.
By the time we got around to race day, and I had CNN with me in my car, and the Today Show, I was dispatching to different parts of the course. And, you know, to see someone go from just another person in the pack. I mean, she was overcoming her own stuff, too, before this all started. But you can see it. You can see something in their eyes. You probably noticed this, Bob. When if someone says, you know, I could never do that, they're right.
Exactly.
But once they say, I can do this, you know, or I'd like to do this, then that is the beginning of a transformative experience for them. And so I look for people that the spark was ignited. And if I see the spark, I like being part of the process where I can help fan it into a flame.
How big has social media become in, I mean, when you talk about media relations, public relations, in the craft of creating interest for your event? How important a role is social playing now?
I think it's critical, and I do think it's successful in various degrees. I mean, I think some people that are drawn to it do a very good job. I think a lot of people do not. You know, it's still a specialty that I think is 5 years away from being really, really solid. So it's hit and miss. With Julie, it was pretty interesting because no matter how much we posted, on the bottom line, it wasn't necessarily effective in generating the donations. But what it was effective in doing was generating the awareness. And I always said, you know, that when someone reads her story or John Ball's story, that day someone was diagnosed with that disease. And those become your new supporters.
Now, how has, you've been in this industry for a long, long time, how has it changed? How is your job different now than it was during the early days of LA Marathon?
I think that's an easy question for me.
Yeah.
I think it's gone corporate,
mm-hmm.
and I think the mom-and-pop races were always focused on customer service in a real meaningful way. You know, the success... Bill Burke used to say, and I love this quote, he said, you know, a marathon is a million moving parts. Something will always go wrong. It's never the same thing 2 years in a row.
Right.
And I found that to be true. And Marie Patrick, gave me very good advice in the first year because when I took over the race to handle the PR for it, I was like the last, you know, I was a one-man boutique agency that would hire up, as necessary for events. And before that, they'd always worked with these big, big firms. And she sent me to the New York Marathon to study their media approach.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, don't copy them. You don't have to copy them. I just want you to see what to do. And so I came back with this tremendous understanding that, it's a big job. Better to be passionate about it. And here's the big advice Marie gave. In all the years we worked on the race, her policy was no one gets the week off after the marathon, that you have to work. The race is on Sunday. You show up for work on Monday, and your next day off is Saturday. The point being that the large majority of the issues that would come up during a race, people start sending emails the next day and making phone calls.
Yes.
You want to be able to put out those fires quickly because now with social media, it's not your friend because, as you know, when a race goes badly.
Yes. It goes viral, and then you don't have a little brush fire, you've got an inferno.
Right. And, you know, then you have to bring in somebody who's a crisis management specialist to try to put that particular inferno out. So I think social media can be your friend, and it can also destroy a race, and you'll need time to rebuild.
One of the things that I always found interesting is, you know, when you're talking about public relations, I think a lot of companies feel that, okay, Lawrence's job is to take care of my sponsors, right? Your job is to sell Honda or sell whoever, come up with media stories around those sponsors. But the media folks are pretty savvy, and being authentic and not insulting them with those type of stories, but hopefully connecting sponsors to authentic stories so that everybody wins. That, to me, is the biggest balancing act there is in what we do.
It absolutely is. And you use the word authentic, and I think you're spot on, because the media is not obligated to put a title sponsor on, you know, on their coverage.
No, yeah.
They can still call it the LA Marathon. It doesn't matter who sponsors it. And I must say, in the years that we worked with Honda, they really respected that, and they did what they could to brand themselves around the city of Los Angeles. You know, they had wrapped buses and they had bus benches and billboards. And there was come January of every year, the race would become more and more visible as a direct result of what Honda was doing around the city. And the only thing that we ever did, which was a nicety for the sponsor and vice versa, was they hosted the lunch of the inspiring stories every year.
Yes.
So we would bring together tables of 10, eight of which would be an inspiring story, two would be seats that were open for media, and when media would show up at that event, they would be given a menu of people.
Interesting. Yes. Here's the story.
So this is, if they're looking for this type of story, this type of story. And we would, we usually had about 80 seats, and, there were never a shortage of compelling stories.
So one of the other programs that came out of LA Marathon, one of my favorites, because I think it changes lives all the time, is Students Run LA. And back in the day, when we first heard that we were going to be encouraging grammar school and high school kids to run a marathon, because it's not like L.A. had a half, right? For a while there, they had a 5K, but they were having kids who really were facing academic challenges, family challenges. All of a sudden, this sport that they probably knew nothing about transformed them and sometimes transformed their whole family.
It far and away was neck and neck with the charity program for something that really got all of us excited every year. And you would see, again, within every race, and this is part of what everyone is about too, is that there are communities of people. And L.A., the Students Run L.A. community, always wore very bright hats, like all 3,000 of the students. And so every year you would be able to spot them. And, there's so many stories of kids that would go on to be the first kid in their family to graduate high school or the first member of their family to go on to college. The dropout rate in LAUSD is upwards of 60%. But students that went through SRLA were graduating at 90% plus.
Wow.
So there was something, and it changed the relationships, because not only did they run the race, but they trained with their teachers. So
I created a bond there too, yeah.
So come race day, they now had this whole new relationship with their teachers that was definitely transformative, and it's a wonderful program. I'm surprised it isn't everywhere.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same way. So when you look back at all the years with LA Marathon and everything between the Elvis and the Run Through Wedding Chapel and Students Run LA and all those type of things, what are you proudest of from over the years?
Well, all of it, but I'm going to actually single out one thing that we haven't talked about. In the years when chip timing was first introduced, I was looking at the racing bibs one day, and I thought, you know what? The only purpose they really serve anymore is to actually promote the race and the sponsors.
Right.
And I thought, wow, there's that whole piece of real estate where the number is that what if we personalized bibs? What if people could have a name or a nickname on their bibs? And then this huge community of 20,000 20,000, 25,000 plus runners when they're having a tough time at mile 18, somebody at the water station can say, hang in there, Lawrence, you're looking good. And we instructed, when we had our volunteer meetings, we instructed them on year one of personalized BIPs that whenever possible, use someone's name.
Wow. And what is the number, when you went to the number company and said, hey, I got an idea. It's not like you're making their job 10 times harder than it was.
Well, actually, it was pretty funny because what we did, which, you know, back in the day, of course, if there was no reason to enter early, you know, other than some price incentives, whatever, there was no reason. So we did a personalized bib deadline.
Mm.
So we ended up getting this infusion of cash, you know, which, of course, Bill and Marie loved. And, you know, it was 3 months out from the race, so we gave them plenty of time to do this. And, you know, I get such a kick when I see them, like, at the Olympics now. You know,
right.
Games on bibs. Yep. And it's like, you know, I'm the guy that nobody knows that innovated all these things, and I'm fine with that. But for the most part, I love marathon runners and half marathon runners, endurance sports athletes, you with challenged athletes. You know, one of the greatest things I can do on any given year is come down for the big event in La Jolla and, you know, get touched by all the joy that these people are experiencing that would not be there without the great work of Challenged Athletes Foundation. And anything we can do, you know, I was thinking about what the driving philosophy in my life is. And it comes down to these four words.
Yeah.
How can I help? And my hope is to get that message out to anybody who has, if you haven't experienced running for a cause, get involved with everyone. Because of the 21 causes, there's one that's going to speak to your heart. Raising money is a lot easier than you think it is for a charity. And it's unbelievably rewarding.
So what are your hopes for year one of Everyone and Everyone.org?
I'd like to, instead of my hopes, I'd like to talk about the Tom
sure.
Houston.
And Sylvia.
Know, his projections are they'd be thrilled if they had 5,000 participants. The course is great. The 21 charities are fired up and motivated to get people to run on their behalf. My hope is that people that are not already associated with those charities are going to want to get involved because they'll experience. I think once you raise money for a cause through an endurance sports event, you never want to go back. I mean, you want to just keep doing that.
Love it. And Lawrence, are you still participating yourself, able to get out there and run and do some spin classes? I know you were big into spinning through the whole Johnny G era.
Oh, yeah. Johnny G, I was one of his test pilots, actually. In the early days in his garage.
Nice.
But I am actually participating in an event called Tour de Cure. Tour de Pure, I'm sorry. And it's on May 15th, which happens to be my birthday.
Nice.
And it's a five-hour spinning event outside right next to the Manhattan Beach Pier overlooking the ocean. And I put together what I call the Team TLC All-Stars. So it's Julie Weiss, it's Eric McIntyre, who rode a bike 6,000 miles
yep.
through 18 states to raise awareness for pancreatic cancer. Lupi Romero, who's a two-time pancreatic cancer survivor. Me, and Sean Bernese, who lost her mom to pancreatic cancer. And we're going to raise money for four different cancer charities, and I can't think of a better way to spend my birthday.
Ooh, love it. Lawrence, thank you so much for taking some time. Congratulations on everything you're doing. And everyone.org, everyone.org, new event series starting up in the San Francisco Bay Area, in Oakland, Berkeley, and we're talking trying to get 5,000 for a first-time event, raising money for 21 charities. And the concept is Everybody raises money for charity. Our other sponsors, Ironman U, RunCatalina.com, our Challenged Athlete Foundation. We've raised over $70 million to keep challenged athletes in game and life through sport. And check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.